From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Historian Howard Zinn takes a look back at how the Electoral College is doing just what it was designed to do, subvert the popular will. Also, what do SlimFast, Jane Fonda, and the Pioneers have in common? A look at the corporations and individuals who are supporting the election lawyers. We'll also go to Tallahassee, looking at the major court rulings on the elections, and as college students fight their school for doing business with the Corrections Corporation of America, we'll bring you part two of an interview with Daruba bin Wahad, who just won a large settlement from the New York City Police Department. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Florida Supreme Court is expected to resume deliberations today in a case that could decide the next president of the United States. The justices could rule on Vice President Al Gore's appeal of a lower court ruling, which denied his request to hand count about 14,000 ballots from Miami-Dade and Palm Beach counties. In addition, rulings are expected in two separate cases before Florida's Leon County Circuit Court. At issue in those cases are irregularities in several thousand absentee ballot applications that have led Democrats to ask that all 25,000 absentee ballots in Seminole and Martin counties be thrown out. Meanwhile, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights is examining whether black voters in Florida were prevented from voting November 7th because of intimidation, discrimination, fraud, or other alleged improprieties. If the bipartisan commission finds that laws were broken, it refers evidence to the Justice Department, which can prosecute. Justice Department representatives are already in Florida to gather information about alleged voting irregularities, but the department has not started a formal investigation. And Florida's Republican-controlled legislature begins an historic effort today to ensure a presidential victory for George W. Bush. The 140 lawmakers are expected to select a slate of 25 presidential electors loyal to Bush to guard against possible losses in the courts. While some Republicans claim that the session is the only way to ensure that Florida's 25 electoral votes will be included in the December 18th meeting of the Electoral College, Minority Leader Lois Finkel said, quote, "I don't believe what we're going to be doing is lawful." And other Republicans, particularly in the more cautious Senate, worried about injecting themselves into an election on behalf of a candidate who was opposed by half of the state's voters. Texas carried out its record 40th and last execution of the year yesterday when it put to death Claude Howard Jones. Jones was the 152nd inmate executed during George W. Bush's tenure as governor. Jeb Bush's state of Florida neared a record of its own when it put to death Edward Castro yesterday. It was Florida's sixth execution of the year, the state's highest number since 1984. Meanwhile, President Clinton postponed yesterday what would have been the first execution out of a federal inmate in 37 years, saying he wants the Justice Department to have more time to gather and analyze information about racial disparities in the federal death penalty system. A Palestinian who's been jailed for 3 years without charges on evidence the government won't disclose what denied his freedom again yesterday when an immigration panel blocked a judge's order to release him. U.S. Immigration Judge R. Kevin McHugh had ordered Mazen al-Najjar's release on $8,000 bond, saying the government failed to give him enough information to defend himself. But the Immigration and Naturalization Service successfully blocked his release when the Board of Immigration Appeal in Washington claimed the case needed further study by a three-judge immigration panel. Congressmember David Bonier, Democrat of Michigan, responded by calling for Attorney General Janet Reno's resignation. He cited government decisions to keep in jail both al-Najjar and Anwar Haddam, who has been held on secret evidence for 4 years in Fredericksburg, Virginia. "In my 25 years in Congress, I have never seen such an act of injustice," Bonier, the minority whip, said from his Washington office. He's called them Gestapo-like tactics. Al-Najjar is among 20 immigrants, mostly Arab Americans, held in U.S. jails without criminal charges on classified evidence. Attorney General Janet Reno expressed misgivings yesterday over the public release of FBI Director Louis Freeh's recommendation against presidential clemency for an American Indian activist imprisoned for killing two FBI agents. Asked at her weekly news conference whether it is appropriate for Freeh to be making public comments on Leonard Peltier's case, Reno replied, "I think these matters should be confined to a discussion with the president." Freeh wrote President Clinton on Tuesday that commuting the life sentences of Peltier would, quote, signal disrespect for law enforcement and the public. The White House said late last month in an interview with WBAI Pacifica Radio that we broadcast on Democracy Now! That Clinton will review pending requests for executive clemency, including Peltier's, before he leaves office in January. Here in New York, a major vigil and rally is set for Leonard Peltier on Sunday across the street from the United Nations.
Okay. God is a concept by which we measure our pain. I'll say it again. God is a concept by which we measure our pain. Yes, we do. I don't believe in magic. I don't believe.
John Lennon singing God here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! The Beatle was assassinated 20 years ago today on December 8, 1980. He was 40 years old. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners across the country. And it's hard to believe that only a year after Lennon was killed, a computer scientist got together to begin developing the protocols for the Internet. And interestingly enough, there was an article in yesterday's Financial Times, which, as if the world didn't have enough to worry about. The article starts off, there are about 6 billion people in the world. They own an estimated 350 million computers, 480 million mobile telephones, 600 million cars, and a billion television sets. But sooner rather than later, all these devices and more want to be on the Internet. Phones will be using the web for mobile commerce, cars to be connected to the net to take advantage of services such as global positioning, and technology companies are working toward a future in which all domestic goods such as refrigerators and television sets and video recorders will all be connected to networks that will have access to the Internet. There's only one problem. There is no room. For any object to be recognized on the Internet, it must have a unique identifier, an address, and the web is running out of addresses. After only 20 years, we have a major problem in the Internet.
And speaking of high tech and high technology, there leaves a lot to be desired though, when it comes to elections, although some say that's a good thing, that elections should be run from the very grassroots level by the people and not by the state. But we are going to go down now to Florida, as we have every day, to look at the race that has not ended yet. A fresh wave of possibly decisive court rulings is expected today in the battle for the White House, which is still unresolved more than a month after the election. The Florida Supreme Court will be ruling on a bid by the campaign of Al Gore to begin an immediate recount of 14,000 ballots from several Florida counties. They're seeking to overturn the official 537 vote lead that Texas Governor George W. Bush holds in Florida. Bush opposes the recount. Meanwhile, two Florida judges will rule over whether to discard 25,000 absentee ballots that lawyers say were tainted because Republicans altered election documents. In the two cases affecting Seminole and Martin counties, judges must decide whether Republicans improperly filled in voter registration numbers on ballots that had already been cast and discarded so that they could be counted as valid. If the judges rule the ballot should be discarded, it would give Gore a lead of thousands of votes. We go now to Leslie Clark, who is staff reporter for the Miami Herald, covering the Florida Supreme Court. Tell us what's happening there today, Leslie Clark.
Well, everybody is pretty much waiting at this point for a ruling from the justices. Nobody really knows at what point they will rule. They're supposed to give us a 30-minute warning when they've reached a decision. It's likely to come today. The last time that they ruled on a decision in this huge election, they ruled within 24 hours of hearing the oral argument.
Well, Leslie Clark, I know it's hard to tell from the questioning of the judges yesterday, but it did seem that several of the judges were much more skeptical toward the Gore team in terms of whether the court should even be considering this case. Or what was your sense from the line of questioning of the justices?
Yeah, the first thing is everyone cautions you against trying to figure it out. The court spokesman says he's only got a 50% record of guessing what they'll do, and he's been there for 14 years. So they truly did, I think, hold both campaigns' feet to the fire yesterday, asking pretty tough questions. As soon as the lawyers introduced themselves, the Chief Justice cut them off and wanted to know whether or not the court even indeed has the authority to intervene in the case.
Explain exactly what the judges will be deciding on today, Leslie Clark.
Well, they have not yet even officially agreed to take up the case. Their first question involved jurisdiction as to whether or not the Florida Supreme Court has the jurisdiction to look at the case, and whether, because of the state constitution, that the legislature is not granted plenary power to select presidential electors. So their first question is going to be, do we even have the authority to be involved in this? Then if they do indeed decide to take it up, their next question will be, what's the resolution? What do we do? Is it truly so many uncounted ballots that we need to order a recount? They're very worried about the time as well. Tuesday, as you know, is the deadline for the states getting in their list of electors.
And assuming, of course, that if they did rule to recount the votes, that the Bush team would immediately appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, I mean, what realistic possibility is there for even if the Supreme Court were to rule, for there to be enough time for these counts to be made? Everything we've heard so far says, what, 3 to 4 days a minimum?
David Boies, the Gore attorney, said that the canvassing boards were going through ballots at about 300 an hour, and there's about 9,000 ballots alone in Miami-Dade County. He seemed to think, however, if they allowed one person, like a court officer, to look at the ballot, that it could go a lot faster. But I can't imagine the campaigns agreeing to have one supposedly nonpartisan, uninterested individual monitoring the ballot.
I know that you're going to have to go, Leslie Clark of the Miami Herald. I want to ask you about this, about Judge N. Sanders Sauls of Leon County Circuit Court. New York Times has it as a front page piece today, how he was hauled to the woodshed by the Florida Supreme Court in what many recall as the most extraordinary professional humiliation in North Florida's recent legal history. Explain what he did.
I'm not all that familiar with the case because I've been covering the cases in the circuit courts, but he apparently sort of took a personal interest in getting rid of one of the clerks of the court some years ago, and he was removed from his position as the chief judge of the circuit. But I've covered the Supreme Court, and they've admonished, publicly reprimanded four South Florida judges this year alone.
We're also joined on the telephone by Phil Long, also from Tallahassee, a staff reporter for the Miami Herald, covering the Seminole trial. Can you talk about what has gone on in that trial for the last day?
Well, we're at the same wait-and-see position that Leslie's in with the Supreme Court. We're waiting for a ruling from Judges Lewis and Clark, which is now affectionately called the Lewis and Clark Expedition. And they're expected sometime today.
Now, in the Seminole trial, in terms of the testimony, what would you say were the most telling points during the trial that the judges will have to rule on?
Well, there's no question, almost no dispute of the facts. Now, there was a Republican operative that had access to perhaps 2,200 ballot application forms, and it's important to understand the difference between the ballot application form and the ballots themselves. And the Republican operative went ahead and added the voter identification numbers, which are a prerequisite to even getting a ballot, and that allowed these 2,200 people to get a ballot. So that's pretty much uncontested. What is the issue here is what's the remedy? Was it wrong? Was it a violation of the law? And then what's the remedy? Judge Clark, she made it pretty clear yesterday. She asked whether this adding or correcting of information is really sufficient to invalidate the ballot, or on the contrary side, if there was some wrongdoing, if the Republicans were treated differently than the Democrats, did that really affect the integrity of the election process? A lot of discussion about the integrity of the election process. So the judge in the Seminole case, over and over asking the lawyers, well, what's the remedy here?
In the Seminole case, it wasn't just the issue of whether the Republicans were permitted, but whether the canvassing board supervisor specifically did not allow the Democrats or independents to have the same access or notify them. Isn't that right? Or
interesting point. The deal was on this. Democrats did it right the first time. When they sent in their application forms, they had the ID numbers on them as they were supposed to. So it wasn't as if the Democrats had a big problem to begin with. But clearly, the supervisor did not notify the Democrats or not notify other people whose absentee ballot applications were insufficient or incomplete.
Were there crimes committed here?
Well, that's what the judge asked. And interestingly, we had a ruling late last night on a similar case, not the Seminole or the Martin case, but there was another case laying out there out of Bay County. And in that, the judge may have set a signal of what might come. And he said very clearly in that case when he dismissed it last night that there was no question that any absentee ballot had been invalidated because of this, that it were put in jeopardy in any way, or any indication that there was not a vote there was will of the people was not expressed in these absentee ballots in another county. Very similar issues, and he basically said no foul here.
And in the Martin case, this is similar arguments being discussed in the courtrooms there yesterday.
Very similar arguments, but in the Martin case, there's another little interesting twist, as opposed to the Seminole and Seminole case, where all the action took place inside the Supervisor of Elections office. In Martin County, the supervisor apparently let the Republican operatives take some of these ballots home or wherever, or not ballots, excuse me, the application forms home or wherever, and do the editing and fixing there, and then brought them back. That's an interesting little twist that they made a lot of discussion about yesterday.
Well, we want to thank you very much for being with us from Tallahassee. Phil Long, staff reporter for the Miami Herald, covering the Seminole trial, and Leslie Clark, staff reporter for the Miami Herald, covering the Florida Supreme Court. When we come back from our break, we're going to look at who's paying for the lawyers on both sides, from actress Jane Fonda to the SlimFast creator Daniel Abraham, and then we're going to talk to Howard Zinn about just the role of the Electoral College, with the Florida legislature calling a special session today to choose their electors. Finally, we're going to be joined by Daruba Bin-Wahad, who is a former Black Panther who just won a major settlement against the New York City Police Department. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Well, Juan, how much is the presidency worth? I don't know if you heard, but it was just put up for bid on eBay. With confusion increasing over who will be our 43rd president, the bidding began at one penny. eBay yanked the item. This was the sale of the White House, as it has done with undeliverable or illegal auctions in the past. Other auctions pulled have included 500 pounds of marijuana and a human kidney. Well, item number 49794568 went up for bid around 9:50 Pacific time on Monday, with bids open for 10 days. Opening at a penny, the bid for the presidency had rocketed to $100 million by 2 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on Monday, shortly after eBay closed down the auction. The auctioneer explained the purpose in the item's description area, said, "Due to the recent ballot confusion in Florida, the presidential election process has been canceled for this term," the auctioneer wrote. "It has now been granted to the common citizen the chance to be president." In the auction description, the auctioneer said that the highest bidder would be sworn in as the 43rd president January 20th and could select the vice president of his or her choice. To qualify, bidders must be 35 or older, a U.S. citizen, and have no felony convictions. The auction went on to say, at the end of the auction, the high bidder will be flown to Washington, D.C. to prepare for inauguration ceremonies and prepped for presidential duty. We feel this is a unique opportunity for Americans, and depending on the results, we'll consider future governmental positions to be selected in this manner. Did you put in your bid on Monday?
No, I am not a fan of eBay, so I rarely go on their site.
Well, speaking of money, we're going to talk now about just how much this contest is costing. Both the Gore and Bush camps are raising millions of dollars to cover the astronomical costs of composed of some of the nation's most powerful attorneys. We turn now to Stephen Weiss, who's with the Center for Responsive Politics. We understand, George Bush won
$1 million, twice his original goal, to finance his legal efforts.
Stephen Weiss, where's this money coming from?
It's coming from the people who have contributed to the campaign in very large amounts for the past couple of years. Many of Bush's pioneers, those are people who raised above a certain large amount for him, or actually gave him that amount, are continuing to give to his recount committee. Kenneth Lay, who is in charge of Enron, other people who have been very strong Republican donors for a long time, one or two folks from Ernst & Young, executives from MBNA, America Bank. These are people who were very strong supporters of George W. Bush all along, saw another opportunity to contribute to him in the form of this recount fund, and did so.
And the Bush campaign has limited the contributions, hasn't it, to $5,000 per individual, and has even posted the names of the contributors on the campaign's website.
That's correct. The law does not require that there be a limit to the contributions. In fact, anyone can give any amount of money to these recount funds, but Bush did limit it to $5,000, and he did put the contributors on his website. In fact, he's been doing so pretty regularly since the recount fund opened, or at least within a few days after that. He didn't have to do that either, in fact, but he chose to do so. And that's why we know so much about who his contributors are.
Now, Gore has just released publicly the people that are giving him money. It sounds like he's raised about half of what Bush has, around $3 million.
Exactly. And his list is also rife with folks that have been very supportive of him for throughout this campaign. You mentioned Jane Fonda. She gave $100,000. S. Daniel Abraham of SlimFast gave $100,000. Stephen Bing, a screenwriter, gave $200,000. Stephen Kirsch of InfoSeek.com, an executive, if not, I think he's the executive there, he gave $500,000 to Gore's recount campaign.
Now, what about these contributions in terms of ethical questions from your perspective? On the campaign, are there any at all?
Well, the meaning of these is the same as it is for any large contributions throughout the campaign. The fact is that money has a very, very important place in American politics, and you're not going to win. In fact, you're not even going to be competitive in wanting to run for Congress or president or really any other office unless you can raise huge sums of money. What that results in is elected officials having two sets of constituents. One is the voters, but the other is the cash constituents, the people who have contributed to the campaign. And those people contribute in part for ideological reasons, but also for business reasons and other reasons. And those people expect something in return for their investment. And that's what the public and organizations like ours, the Center for Responsive Politics, are out there doing.
And for those Americans out there who thought all those lawyers that they're watching on television were volunteering their effort to defend their preferred candidate, you have any idea what these lawyers are getting paid?
No, I don't. But the lawyers are working way too hard not to get compensation. Certainly, the TV time and just the cachet of having represented a presidential candidate will do them well in the future, but I doubt their services are for free. But I don't know how much they're getting paid. I'm not sure anyone will ever know how much they're getting paid.
Stephen Weiss, I want to thank you for being with us from the Center for Responsive Politics. If you want to see where the candidates get their money from, you can go to the center's website at opensecrets.org.
Yes, opensecrets.org.
Opensecrets.org. Thanks for being with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we turn now to historian Howard Zinn. It's been 132 years since the Florida legislature got this involved in presidential politics, but some things never change. The GOP majority wanted to send a Republican to the White House then, and it does now. Today, Florida's Republican-controlled legislature is holding a special session to try to deliver a presidential victory to George W. Bush. The 140 lawmakers are convening to approve a special slate of 25 presidential electors loyal to Bush. On the eve of the special session, House Speaker Tom Feeney, the most forceful advocate for the gathering, acknowledged he's been speaking with Bush's brother, Governor Jeb Bush, State Republican Chair Al Cardenas, and former state GOP Executive Director Randy Enright. Democrats are accusing Bush's team of orchestrating the event to guard against losses in the courts. We now turn to Howard Zinn, who we will now ask to shoot from his new hip in Boston. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Well, thank you.
How are you feeling? I know you just had a hip operation.
Well, I'm feeling fine. I mean, you can't tell on the telephone, of course, but what my hip looks like. But I'm getting better every day.
Good.
I've graduated from two crutches to one crutch to a cane, and someday I'll be able to maneuver on two legs.
Well, you sound like you're in better shape than the U.S. election system, so congratulations. It's at least someone's worse off than you.
I need more than crutches.
Well, as most people know, Howard Zinn is a historian and wrote A People's History of the United States, 1492 to the present. May have sold more copies than the Bible, I'm not sure. But tell us what the Electoral College, why it first came into being.
Well, the Electoral College came into being, of course, with the Constitution. The Constitution was adopted in Philadelphia by, you know, our founding fathers. A lot of paternalism there, and they met in through the summer and early fall of 1787, adopted the Constitution, and debated all of the provisions of the Constitution. And when they came to the question of how to elect a president, there was a rather lively debate over how the president should be elected and how many years should a president serve and should there be a vice president and so on. And there were several proposals made that the president should be simply elected by popular vote. And those proposals were immediately knocked down. And which was not surprising, because the founding fathers were really not inclined to have a real popular choice of the people who would run our government. They decided that they would, in fear, really, of having a popular vote for president. You know, they kept talking about, no, we must have, you know, people who are intelligent, people who are educated, people who, which usually is a shorthand for people of means and people of power and people who are you know, important people in the community. They're the ones who should make the decision. So they finally decided that, actually they gave the job to a committee, and the committee came back and made their suggestion. They immediately adopted the committee's report, and report was that, well, we should let each state legislature choose a group of electors, that these electors will then decide who is the president. There was no thought of popular selection of president. The idea was that a select group of men, now you might say doubly select, since the state legislatures themselves, which would select the electors, were at that time not elected by popular vote. There was only one state, Pennsylvania, where the state legislature was elected by popular vote. That is by, you know, universal, well, even male suffrage. In all the other states, the popular vote was, well, severely circumscribed by the fact that you had to be a white male, and you had to own property. That was the case in 12 of the 13 states. So you had, right from the start, with the election of the state legislators, you had an undemocratic process, no popular election, and then the state legislators themselves would, without referring to any popular vote, choose the electors. So now keep in mind that the same constitutional convention decided that the United States Senate would not be elected by popular vote, that the Senate would also be selected by, two senators would be selected by state legislatures. So if you look at the three branches of government as a whole, here's what you find. You find that the president is not going to be elected by popular vote. You find the Senate is not going to be elected by popular vote. The House of Representatives will be elected by, whatever means the state legislatures decide they will be elected, because voting requirements were left up to the states. And the Supreme Court, of course, would be selected by the president. So you did not have, coming from the founding fathers, the idea that the people who would run the country would be elected by popular vote. I mean, what's astonishing, or maybe not so astonishing, is here over 200 years later, we are still operating with an undemocratic system of electing the President of the United States, a system which not only was flawed from the beginning by the requirements of the Founding Fathers, but has become more and more flawed as the election process has become dominated by two major parties which monopolize the political arena, and dominated more and more by the fact that money decides who can reach the American people.
Howard Zinn, I'd like to ask you, this is Juan Gonzalez. In your book, People's History of the United States, you so eloquently document how the gap between the myth that most Americans have of the development of American democracy and the fact that many of the advances in popular rule came as a result of people's struggles to get them. And, of course, one of the issues that a lot of the media right now are referring back to as the last time we had an electoral crisis of this nature is the Hayes-Tilden battle in 1876. But there hasn't really been much in-depth look at what were the issues surrounding that and why that was such a seminal point in American history in terms of Reconstruction. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
You know, what's interesting to me is that while for the first time in a very long time, the Hayes-Tilden election has come into the headlines, you know, because of what we're experiencing now. In all the discussion that I have seen in the press and on television of the Hayes-Tilden election, I haven't seen anybody in the major media talk about what was behind the Hayes-Tilden compromise. That is, they talk about it as if it was simply a contest between Republicans and Democrats, and the Democrats won the popular vote, but the Republicans, you know, by their domination of the political process, managed to put Hayes into office. But nothing is said about what were the real issues behind that. The real issues behind that were that there was a kind of agreement made between Republicans and Democrats. And the agreement was that the Democrats would go along with the election of a Republican president, even though the Democrats had won a popular vote, so long as the Republican president would guarantee to bring the federal troops out of the South. Federal troops had been the ones there guaranteeing that the 14th and 15th Amendments would be enforced, that black people would be allowed to vote. And so the agreement was that, and this is called so the Great Compromise of 1877, they would allow a Republican to become president, but in return, the Republican would do in the South what a Democratic president would do, and that is basically return the rule of the South to the plantation owners who had ruled it before, and return black people to a condition, if not of slavery legally, of semi-slavery, because they would no longer have the protection of the federal government, no longer have the right to vote. They certainly would have no economic resources, and economic deals were made between the wealthy interests of the South and the commercial industrial interests of the North in order to settle the election that way. But as I say, what is left out of the discussion is the issue of race and of economics, of race and class. What that election signaled was that that brief period of Reconstruction in which black people could vote, black people would be elected to state legislatures, even a black man become senator from Mississippi, that in which segregation began to be pulled apart, that brief period of the early 1970s was put to an end by the Hayes-Tilden Compromise of 1877. And it's shameful that none of the discussion around that disputed election has gone into, you know, that fundamental issue. But, of course, this is typical of the American culture and the American media, that all issues are discussed at the most superficial level, and that the issues behind political decisions, which are issues that are concerned with wealth, with class, with race, those issues, the most crucial issues in American society, are ignored. Instead, they talk about Republicans and Democrats and votes in the Electoral College, and it contributes to the continued ignorance of the American public about what is behind politics.
What I'd like to do is ask you one last question, but we have to take a 60-second break. And that last question is your view that the current crisis now, this battle for the presidency, is reflecting any deeper contradictions or struggles that are going on in the society? If you can think about that while we take a 60-second break.
Yeah.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We're speaking with historian Howard Zinn, author of, among other books, A People's History of the United States. We'll be back in a minute. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we finish up with historian Howard Zinn, author of A People's History of the United States. Juan?
Yes, and I was asking before the break whether, Howard Zinn, you thought that the battle that's going on now, whether it is reflective of some deeper contradictions within American society at this time, or whether it's just what it appears to be, a battle between two corporate parties for control of the White House.
Well, it is a battle between two corporate parties, and what the battle conceals, because all of the emphasis in the media is on, well, will Bush be the president, or will Gore be the president? Will this corporate representative, or the other corporate representative, be the president? What conceals is the fact that whichever of these two becomes president, we will not have a popularly elected president. That is, we will not have a president chosen by the American people. Remember, half the American people who were eligible to vote did not vote. I would argue that a great many of them did not vote because they didn't see any fundamental difference between the candidates. Of those, of that 50% of the population that did vote, I would argue that many of them, and maybe a majority of them, did not vote with enthusiasm for either candidate, but voted for one or the other because those were the only choices they had, or the only choices that they felt they had. So that I think what we are seeing is a keeping out of the view of the public the fact that the political process is a corrupt process, that the political system that we have now is not a democratic political system. And to view it totally as a contest between Gore and Bush and make it seem as if the fate of the world depended on it, it's as if sort of people were having a tennis match on the deck of the Titanic, and everybody was transfixed to see who would win the match. And that's how it looks to me.
Well, Howard Zinn, I want to thank you very much for being with us, author of A People's History of the United States and so much more. And I hope you are recovering well.
Thanks very much, Amy.
Thank you. Howard Zinn speaking to us from Boston. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Howard Zinn, well known for covering people's movements in this country. Well, in the last week, there was a 34-hour sit-in that was staged upstate New York at Ithaca College, where students took over the administration offices. They were protesting the fact that they're required to buy a meal plan that is provided by Sodexo Marriott. And Sodexo Marriott's parent company, Sodexo Alliance, is a major shareholder in the Corrections Corporation of America. We're joined on the phone for a minute by Kate Ree, who is with the Prison Moratorium Project. Explain what these connections are and why students are so concerned about them.
Sure. I just want to mention that the protests happened not only at Ithaca, but Buffalo State College, back-to-back actions, which was very fantastic. The tie is simple. Students are forced to buy a meal plan from Sodexo Marriott Food Service Provider, which contracts at over 500 college campuses in North America. And Sodexo Marriott's parent company, Sodexo Alliance, is the largest investor in the CCA, Corrections Corporation of America, which is the largest private prison building industry. And students are protesting the college's ties to private prison, calling attention to the malpractices that have been covered widely in the media in the private prison industry in terms of cutting corners in order to save costs. And the student actions have been nationwide. The success has been It's been very impressive how students have been able to organize, calling attention to not just the private prison industry, but to the larger prison industry that's expanding. And also as students, they are able to call attention, especially in New York State, to the funding trade-off that has taken place over the last 10 years, where we've seen a ballooning corrections budget for the prison construction, while the public higher education budget has been falling, almost a dollar-for-dollar trade-off.
If people want to get more information on Sodexo Marriott, Corrections Corporation of America, and this university movement, where can they go on the web?
www.nomoreprisons.org is a good site to go to, and then we can give them links to all the other resources out there.
So that's nomoreprisons.org. Kate Ree of the Prison Moratorium Project, I want to thank you for being with us. And prisons is the subject of our final segment today. On May 19, 1971, two New York City police officers were wounded in a burst of machine gun fire while standing guard outside the Manhattan DA's office. 2 years later, after three trials, a Black Panther leader, Drew Bin-Wahad, was convicted of the crime by a jury that deliberated by less than an hour. He was sentenced to 25 years to life. As a result of Daruba Bin-Wahad's federal lawsuit against the FBI in the city, saying that he had been framed by an FBI police smear campaign, the agency released over 300,000 pages of secret documents about the counterintelligence program. This week, Daruba Bin-Wahad was going to trial in his civil lawsuit against the police and the FBI. But at the last minute, on the eve of jury selection, the city caved and settled for about $490,000. We began this conversation yesterday on Democracy Now! Today, Daruba Bin-Wahad is in with us to finish it up. Daruba Bin-Wahad, for 25 years, you waited to tell your story. You almost had the chance this week in a courtroom in New York as you attempted to force onto the witness stand New York City police officers who arrested you and the authorities who had you convicted and kept you in prison for 19 years. Well, you're not going to tell it in a courtroom, but tell it here.
Well, I don't think we've got enough time to tell it here, but It's very difficult to, as I said yesterday, I may have misled people to think that my attorneys at the time of during this my appeal and my 440 and mainly my 440 in this suit was Mary Johnson Lowe. That's not what I meant. Mary Johnson Lowe was the judge, the federal judge, who preserved my case, who kept my case alive for for a very long time because she felt that the government and the state were being dishonest in their responses to our interrogatories and our requests for documents. She proved to be right, and we proved to be right, and the FBI eventually turned over 400,000 pages of documents and discovery in this suit. Those documents were the ones that immediately led to my overturning my state conviction. Now, in relationship to the suit, of course, I wanted to use the courtroom as a forum to expose to an entire generation of young people in this country, and in this city in particular, the basis and the roots of racial profiling in this city as we know it today. Of course, we know racial profiling has its roots in slavery. It has its roots in the slave system, in the chattel slave system. But it has undergone evolution as America has undergone evolution to deal with this ever-developing population, this ever-diverse population. So the Black Panther Party in this city was a significant target of law enforcement agencies and prosecutorial agencies in this city. And they cooperated extensively with the FBI and with other federal law enforcement agencies in order to destroy the effectiveness of organizations like the Black Panther Party on the community level, on the grassroots level. And to do that, an important component of their strategy, an important tactic of their strategy, was criminalization, demonization. Of course, we know they still do that today. You know, the media still demonizes dissent in this country, marginalize it, criminalize in many ways the culture of dissent. In other words, those things that come out of marginalized cultures, oppressed cultures, they tend to to trivialize it, criminalize it, or otherwise put it in some category where the mainstream population would find it somewhat alien or strange. And this is what they did with the Black Panther Party. There was a concerted, I mean, this is documented. There was a concerted media, government, and law enforcement blitz against the Black Panther Party. I don't mean that, you know, the law enforcement went after the Black Panther Party and the media just reported the news as they saw it. The media was active participants in setting up people in the party, which brings us to a crucial question today, which we were just discussing with Professor Howard Zinn. What is the role of media in democracy today, given the level of technology in the modern nation state? America has to rethink democracy in dynamic terms that they haven't contemplated before. And so it's very important. It was very important to me at this point in our history to try to tell this story. Now, Amy, it's very difficult. As all of us here know, and many people in the listening audience who are activists know, it's very difficult to bring forward a political analysis of a period of time, to bring forward a grassroots or a people's a version of a historical event that has been demonized and criminalized by the media. And you know, the shooting of policemen in any society is a very serious offense, because the police are the first armed agents of the state. But the fact of the matter is, that is what they are. They are agents of the state. And the state, as we were just discussing, is owned lock, stock, and barrel by corporations, the rich, and the elite in this country. State people do not control state policies, the state legislatures, the state's political systems. We know that now. A lot of people are seeing that for the first time. But we knew that back in the 60s. So when they came after organizations like the Black Panther Party in this city, they found a ready acceptance for their program and their agenda from certain segments in this city, namely different communities in Bensonhurst, out in Brooklyn, the same communities that were maligned recently in the Park Slope brouhaha, the Doris Mon case, the Louima case. All these communities in this city were at one time targeted under COINTELPRO, and the local law enforcement agencies carried out these programs. So I just want to say that trying to tell this story in the court is extremely difficult, because what they do is they hamstring you with rules. so that you can't say this, or if you say that, you have to say it in a certain context. If you don't say it in a certain context, then you're going to be penalized. So it was very difficult to deal with that in the courtroom, but we felt that we would prevail.
Well, interestingly enough, the city officials, just as the federal government in a previous trial or in a previous suit of yours, basically chose to settle while at the same time claiming that they were still convinced that you were guilty, even though your conviction had been overturned, but that they were just doing the cost-effective approach. What's your response to their statements?
Well, you know, this case has been pending since 1975. It was one of the longest pending cases in the Southern District of New York. And if they really were considering cost effectiveness, if it was really the taxpayers concerned with, they would have settled this case years ago. The only reason they settled at this particular moment because we were on the eve of trial and the judge told them, to the words to the effect that although my ruling seemed to gut the plaintiff's case, his ability to present his case, that they should not, that is the defense, the city should not look at those rulings as and think that they, you know, it protects them, because their greatest burden is to overcome the fact that I was released from state prison and that there was a finding in a court of law that the evidence that was in my, that was withheld, could have changed the opinion of a jury. So that there was a major obstacle that they would have to overcome, and they knew that they couldn't overcome that obstacle unless they could prejudice the jury.
Among the most important bits of evidence that the prosecution withheld from you and your defense lawyers was that there was this anonymous recorded conversation, message of a woman who said, "You are not involved with the shooting of the police officers." She ended up being a key prosecution witness,
yes,
who implicated you, and they never said that they actually had this tape recorded previous.
That's true.
Voice recording that said, where she said you weren't involved.
And in fact, when we discovered the voice recording, we discovered it in a newspaper, in a news magazine article called Target Blue, written by a former police commissioner for public relations named Daly. If you would have to understand, we have to really understand. I know we're running out of time, but a lot of listeners have to understand that in 1971, New York was in a serious crisis. The police department, there was a freeze on hiring by the police department. The PBA was trying to carry out a campaign to open up the ranks of the police department. So they were antagonizing the black community. There was a high level of murders of police, of minority youth, during 69 to 71. And the mayor's office, Mayor Lindsay, was under considerable pressure by the Latino and black communities in this city for better health care, better public safety, and all of these things. So when the Panther 21 were acquitted, it was a major blow to the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. And the way they got back out of that, the way they got to vindicate themselves, was to frame me and manufacture this evidence with Pauline Josephs.
Well, on that note, we have to wrap up. Also in the evidence was a letter between J. Edgar Hoover, a memo, and President Richard Nixon, who was involved in your case.
Yes, President Richard Nixon was the one that mobilized the FBI to start a program called New Kill, which was the follow-up to the counterintelligence program. When the counterintelligence program was discovered in 1974 to 75, New Kill was initiated in 1971. Long before COINTELPRO went out. So it was under the auspices of Richard Nixon.
Well, this is a conversation to continue. Daruba Bin Wahad, former Black Panther, settled a lawsuit with the New York City Police and FBI for close to $500,000 this week. Democracy Now! Produced by Maria Carrion and Terry Allen. Matthew Finch is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!